Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, PK, from Third Stream View. And welcome back, everyone, for Monday evening, October 24th, 2011. Once again, I'd like to always thank our hosts, bbsradio.com, for promoting free speech, for promoting alternative radio, which I really appreciate, so we can get our message out, as opposed to the corporate statist usual opinion cartel of the major media. Moving right along here, I'll get to my guests in a minute, but we've gotten rid of the evil Gaddafi. I know he was tremendously threatening the U.S., and now we wonder what's going to take his place. Who knows? It might be worse. But as far as dictators go, as I understand it, he was a pretty good thing for Libya. He wanted to introduce a gold-backed currency. He actually wanted to, as I understand it, give a lot of the oil revenues directly to the people, but his parliament overruled that. And so now we got rid of this bad guy, and who knows what's going to take his place. So, NATO, Britain and France, and then the U.S. overthrowing this guy and costing us billions. What, do we have to rebuild this country now while our country is broke? Meanwhile, we've got, 20 to 25 million people unemployed. And yet last night, Bill Maher was going on about, yeah, this guy, he's Obama. Yeah, he got Gaddafi, then al-Awlaki, and now, he got Osama bin Laden, and then al-Awlaki, and now Gaddafi. Wow. Yeah, so who knows what's going to follow all this. So moving on to my guest, I'm glad to have on my friend Scott Kajar. He's got one of those, what sounds to me like a Scandinavian name where they should buy some more vowels. But I first met Scott in 1990 when he was fortunate enough to be my roommate at Stanford out there near San Francisco for the Mises University course. It's a week-long course put on by the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which I attended, and boy, did that open my mind up further, not only to economics, which I was already there as a free market advocate, having read a lot, but also the revisionist history and the things I learned about Adam Smith and these other things from Rothbard's lectures and Bob Higgs, and it was an amazing experience. And kids who still attend this say the same thing. It's amazing. They learn more in a week than they often learn in all of college in certain ways. So I'm really glad to have attended. And my friend Scott went on to become, I believe he's a doctorate, or he's a professor in economics, and he is an Austrian economist. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have a full-blooded, full-blown Austrian economist, Austrian school economist, I should say. So anyway, I want to welcome Scott. Scott, are you out there, my friend?
I'm hanging in here. How are you, PK?
Good. Thank you for your patience. Before we start, would you care for some tea or coffee?
I've got a Coke in front of me.
Good, because it's self-service here.
That's right.
Well, thank you for coming on. So let me hear a little bit about your background. Am I right? You are a professor, and you did get your you have a doctorate now?
That's right, a PhD in economics, a master's degree in economics, a master's degree in public policy analysis. Bachelor's degree in English with a minor in political science.
That's amazing. I'm a college dropout, but we'll see if you can keep up with me today.
Education's got very little to do with degrees. You can be the most educated guy in the room and not have any degree whatsoever.
Thank you very much, Professor. And I like that old Mark Twain dictum, I think, where he said, never let school get in the way of your education.
That's right. In fact, when you think about it, one of the most educated guys on the planet is Ben Bernanke, but he's also one of the least educated when it comes right down to understanding what's going on in the world.
How dare you say that? Because did he not do his doctorate thesis or something like that on the Great Depression?
That's right, and he got it wrong. He should have read Rothbard.
Are you saying that John Maynard Keynes is wrong?
We're in the long run, and Keynes is dead, just as he predicted.
Yeah, well, I look forward to the third video where he's duking it out with Hayek.
Yeah, well, he's punched Hayek pretty hard in those first two.
I know.
Hayek might not want another rematch.
Well, it's time for a young Rothbard or Mises to clash with him, or myself. I'm available. So
there you go.
Now, let's step back a little bit. You were teaching, I believe, in the great state of Alabama.
That's been a few years. Most recently, I was teaching in the great state of Minnesota, but that was a little cold for my taste.
Right, a little cold for your taste, and as I understand it from an email you had sent, quite status in the university, or quite wasn't you didn't enjoy the environment too much, besides the bad weather.
Well, I was at a big impersonal state university, and I'm accustomed to teaching where I have 30 or 35 or 45 students in my class, and so I can discuss things with them. I can expect students to interact. But at the big impersonal state university, I was teaching 400 students per semester. I had no teaching assistant, no grading assistant, no anything, which means all I could do was just give Scantron tests. And Scantron tests are the dumbest things ever imaginable.
Well, Scott, does this stem from the fact that you may have lobbied for smaller classrooms in the past and you got stuck with a bigger one?
Well, it was just the nature of the fact that it's a state university. State universities nearly everywhere are just like that. They teach students in great, huge lecture halls.
Right. Well,
you know, well,
apart from students, Scott, what about the faculty and the other economics teachers? Were you in a sea of Keynesianism there?
There were certainly some Keynesians. Most universities these days try to take a sort of an eclectic approach. So one of my colleagues was a Marxist, a couple were Keynesians, a couple were Chicago guys. It's sort of a mix and match.
Some of them,
as far as I'm concerned, weren't really economists. They just looked at statistics all the time.
Were you in any friendly discussions with them off campus or, you know, over a beer?
Well, a couple of times I tried to have friendly discussions, but for the most part I found that the pro-free market voices didn't really participate in those discussions, and the anti-free market voices very much took it for granted that, of course, markets fail and it's necessary to have government to step in and prop things up. I'll give you an example. I was having a talk with my department head about the current economic conditions and the meltdown, and she said that she found this to be a perfect example that she could teach her kids about how markets fail and how important good regulation is. And I laughed, and I said, I use this as an example to teach my students how regulation fails and how important free markets are. She looked at me like she couldn't imagine what I was talking about.
It's amazing how clueless these people are.
And she's got a PhD and is a very well-respected professor.
Not by me. Well, interestingly enough, I don't have a PhD, but I'm fairly well-read. I, you know, nothing near what you've read, but I'm certainly on the same page. My whole thing is a cut-to-the-chase point of view of how to fix things. First of all, I wouldn't have bailed, and I'm sure you agree with a lot of this, I wouldn't have bailed out anybody. I would have let them go bankrupt and let them reorganize, but in an atmosphere of micro-taxes and micro-regulations.
That would have both of those things, obviously. Great improvement.
Yeah, and as you know, we differ because I believe that you were probably an advocate of anarchy capitalism, and I'm a minarchist.
Well, so we'll just
but I'm
we'll
not
just
arguing.
Kill you last after we kill the real statists.
Thank you. Well, I'm not arguing or trying to split hairs with you. I'm just saying in the society I've laid out through my secession solution, I don't know if you ever got to read that, but there's not too much we would disagree on nor go to war over.
Well, you know, like Murray Rothbard once said, when people agree on 99% of the stuff and disagree on 1%, let's institute that first 99%, and then we'll argue about the rest.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Scott, because I'm also a gradualist, and I hope you realize that, of course, you want to do this, abolish that, but I'm sort of like in the Ron Paul, of course, I'm a very staunch Ron Paul supporter, having also worked on his 1988 campaign, is that I'm a gradualist, and yes, I want to abolish these things and get rid of them, but I want to do it gradually because I don't want more revolution. I don't need more out of control occupied Wall Street mentality or people who are clueless about a lot, although in a way I'm very narrowly in agreement with them on a few things about corporate welfare, crony capitalism, the wars. But I would, you know, take care of the people on Social Security and cut the young people loose, and I would want to phase out Medicare and Medicaid but put something in their place, including probably vouchers that the states would give to their own poor. You know, I'm just concerned about that whole thing. I don't need a revolution in that aspect. But there's so much we can get rid of in the meantime, like the drug war. And another thing I like to say is that, well, all states, every state already has a Department of Transportation, a Department of Agriculture, a Department of Education. Why are we paying for these federal ones? So that's a way to downsize to get there. And I also like to say, all these federal employees that I would fire or eliminate, I would, you know, I would give them a year full pay of their pay and benefits for a year, and then that's it. That's how I would try to do it, instead of bluntly doing it. I don't know if you agree or if you don't agree. What would be your methodology, keeping in mind, rioting and all this other stuff?
Well, I have a little different solution. But I think yours is, you and I agree that we don't want to have some sort of instant revolution that just causes chaos.
Exactly.
My suggestion for how to downsize the federal government is to offer this incentive to every federal employee. If you can identify waste and fraud in your department or program, we'll give you 10% of it and then abolish your job. If you can find $1 billion of waste and fraud, we'll give you $100 million and have you go away.
You're more generous than I am.
Think about it. If we just saved 90% of all the waste and fraud in the federal government, and the people who are committing the waste and fraud are the people who are going to know how to find it, this gives them the very incentives they need to come forth and ferret out all the fraud.
I like your idea, but what about all the secretarial staff and all that crowd, the clerical staff? What about them?
I think they're going to be the first ones to find the waste and fraud.
Really?
Don't you think so? You think that the secretarial staff are the ones who know where the bodies are buried? They're the ones who know who's been up the shenanigans, and they're the first ones who are going to come forward and say, "I'm making $45,000 a year. Here am I identifying $1 billion worth of waste and fraud. I'll take my money and go home. Thank you very much."
Yes. I see that. I don't know if that would apply for, you know, a lot of just people, all the sheeple who are just doing what they got to do, typing, doing what their whole deal is. But something's got to be done. And Dr. Paul hasn't mentioned the drug war again. I guess that freaks out conservatives too much. But it's a tremendous waste. It's I think it started pretty much with Nixon, who gave us the DEA and the EPA.
Right.
And so, as I understand it, this drug war since 1969 has been over $1 trillion of failure.
Well, I'll take your word for that. I don't know the statistics on the drug war.
I heard it on a radio show last month or 2 months ago, and it was actually coming from some conservatives. It was more local talk. It was actually conservatives talking about the futility of it and what a waste it's been. So that alone is a huge chunk. Think what that would do in the lessening of the crime and, you know, the lessening of all this ridiculous prison construction as a result of – I like to accuse Reagan of this because, you know, excuse me, St. Reagan. It was St. Reagan who would often say, you know, well, government's not the solution, it's the problem. Then he launches a massive increased drug war and, centrally planned, very socialistic, of course, and the massive incarcerations, the prison constructions, the deaths, the suffering, especially the destruction of black inner city areas and that whole deal and the crime spree. So, you know, that's one way to really lessen this tragedy of the drug war.
That's right. In fact, I like to sometimes say to people, Reagan was great. If only Reagan had been president instead of whoever that guy was that did all the things that Reagan said he was opposed to.
Yeah, well,
if government is not the solution, it's the problem, then why did that guy who called himself Reagan give us so much government? So you're exactly correct on that.
Well, I usually am. And
thank you very much. That's why you're the PK.
Absolutely. A man of liberty and property and peace type PK. And here we have St. Reagan, who said his lines well, but as I'm fond of quoting myself, St. Reagan's performance record never matched his free market rhetoric.
Well, you know, there's a lot of guys like that. I like to think that Thomas Jefferson would have been great if only he would have been president, too. Because the Thomas Jefferson who gave us the Declaration of Independence and the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions is very different from the Thomas Jefferson who was the president. So all of these guys, I think you get into power, and power is seductive. And it doesn't matter what your previous views were, when you have power, suddenly you think, well, now that I've got power, I can use it for good. The trouble is that you can't use power for good. No matter how well-intentioned you are, no matter how strong you think your beliefs are, Ronald Reagan showed that when he got into power, he created all kinds of new programs, even though we talk about him getting rid of them. Thomas Jefferson came to power. He created all kinds of programs, things that later he looked back and said, how did we get all this stuff? How did we get here? And the answer was, Mr. Jefferson, you gave it to us. So I think that this idea that you can use power for good, it's seductive, but it's false.
I recall years ago stopping at the Mises Institute, and you were still there, and you had told me that Jefferson was actually better out of office than he was when he was in office, and I remember that you telling me that, so that's a reflection on what you just said. If I was running the show, I would implement my new constitution, which I've written. It's very Austrian. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's very Austrian and libertarian in scope, and it doesn't deprive anybody of anything. It doesn't take away any of their current rights. There's no conscription. There's no stationing troops overseas. There's not only is there a gold standard, but there is nothing standing in the way of other commodities that might come into the marketplace or competitive currencies, of course. So that's what I would hold myself account to, is the Constitution that I wrote, which I like to say takes away nothing from anybody. Yes, there'll be government employees fired, but they will soon be absorbed through a massively growing, thriving private sector.
Yeah, in fact, Henry Hazlitt makes interesting arguments about that exact issue in his wonderful little book, Economics in One Lesson.
Read it.
People like to say, geez, if you shrink the government, look at all these people you're going to lay off. But at the same time, we have to say, if you shrink the government, look at the money the government isn't spending that can now be returned to the taxpayers, and now the taxpayers will spend that money. And when the taxpayers start spending that money, that's where you actually get real jobs, producing real things for real people, not government jobs, just moving things around and causing problems.
Of course, of course. Let me ask you I am one who never demonizes China, by the way, and I understand about a worldwide division of labor. Am I correct in saying that a lot of this relocation to China comes because American industry is massively overregulated and taxed? Is that
absolutely
okay?
This is just a simple case of incentives. I mean, let's take a simpler case. Let's talk about McDonald's. Now, McDonald's is the classic minimum wage employer. McDonald's hires a lot of people who have never had a job before, gives them their first job. But now, suppose you're McDonald's, and if you think back 25 or 30 years ago, McDonald's didn't have all the warming trays that they have now. They didn't have all the microwaves they had now. Instead, you came in and ordered, and they cooked your hamburger right then, and they made your fries right then, or they cooked your Egg McMuffin right then. It was all done at that time. But as the minimum wage gets higher and higher, McDonald's says, gee, we have a case where we can continue to hire labor to have a lot of people here during busy times, or we can acquire more capital, more machines, more equipment, and use equipment, have less labor on hand, because labor is more expensive than machines. So when you price labor out of the market, it only stands to reason that McDonald's is going to get more warming trays, more microwaves, and fewer employees. Well, it's the same thing on a different scale when we look at China. As we get more regulation in the U.S., it becomes more costly to produce things in the U.S. It only stands to reason that companies in China are going to be able to outcompete companies in America. Even if American workers are more productive, and American workers are among the most productive workers in the world, we rock when it comes to how much we can produce, the government is tying the hands of our employers, so it's no wonder that we, the consumers, say, I'd rather buy that cheap product at Walmart than a more expensive American-made product because I can't afford the American-made product. The government has made it too expensive for me. So that's a simple reflection of government policy, nothing more, nothing less.
At this point, I would like to say or ask you then, well, however, those microwaves and warming trays, they are built by other employees. So who's to say that that wouldn't have come anyway, automation? Maybe the minimum wage laws made it come sooner.
Well, yeah, the question becomes, when is always the right time to do something? Anytime government steps in and changes the incentives, government will skew the outcome. Maybe those things would have come later. Maybe those things never would have come at all. Maybe we would have a whole army of people doing more things instead of more automation. When you look at, let's look at it as auto workers then. When auto workers keep raising their wages higher and higher and higher, and government kept supporting those higher and higher wages, we saw that factory after factory got converted to production by robots instead of production by Americans. And the reason is because it became more profitable to use robots than it was to use people. It's not that automation is necessarily better or necessarily worse. It's a simple cost question. If labor is too expensive relative to capital, you're going to use capital. But if labor is less expensive relative to capital, you're going to use more labor. It's a simple trade-off. And so government policy can affect this. If government leaves the market alone, then the free market is going to say, we will compensate labor according to its productivity, we compensate capital according to its productivity, and then we hire the right mix of labor and capital to be efficient. But then government steps in and starts changing the rules and gives tax breaks for certain things or raising taxes on other things, government is going to skew that mix. They're going to push the outcome in a particular direction. The trouble is that the free market can discipline itself. Government can't really discipline the market. So we've had too much bloat, waste, and fraud in the American auto companies, for example, and now we see the American auto companies have all failed. That's because of changes in government policy over the year. It's not because of the free market. It's not because the Americans couldn't compete. It's because the Americans were all but prevented from competing by government policy. So now we all buy Japanese cars. We buy Korean cars. One of these days we'll probably start buying Chinese cars, not because Americans can't produce better, but because the government has made it so that it's not profitable to do so.
Well, when I go buy a part somewhere, like for my pool or whatever, I go to the counter and say, I want the best Chinese parts you have. But anyway, something I gathered from reading Austrian literature is that, in a nutshell, I like to say that American labor unions, by their strikes and their threats of strikes for decades now, have imposed above market wages on American employers. Is that a good analogy?
Well, you have to be careful there. Everybody wants to get paid more. I want to get paid more in my job. You want to get paid more. Everybody wants to get paid more. And so in that sense, I'd say that you can't fault the labor unions and their members for saying that they want to be paid more. Everybody wants to be paid more. The problem comes, again, in government policy. If you have a free market, then people can join the labor union or not. The labor union can go on strike or not. And if the labor union goes on strike, then maybe by virtue of the fact that the entire workforce has gone out on strike, they have the power to bargain against the company. But maybe they don't, depending on the economic situation. However, under the current situation, the government has all kinds of laws that protect the labor union. So again, the government has skewed the incentive has skewed the market. If you get rid of those government protections for labor unions, then what you have are real labor unions in the free market. And then you're going to see a situation where labor unions aren't the bad guys and corporations aren't the bad guys, and it doesn't have to be finger-pointing like it is now, because it's not going to be us against them. So I'm not one of these guys that wants to blame the labor union. I think it all comes back to government policy that skews the incentives in favor of the labor union.
Well, I believe that. I agree. But I honestly refer to myself as being pro-employee but anti-union. And I think that over the years, unions have become very anti-competitive and monopolistic. And, of course, it's probably mostly due to the government protection that they receive.
Absolutely.
So in my world, there's no, and I'm sure yours too, there's no political privilege for industry or labor, you know, management or labor.
That's right, and that's the big situation we have right now, and that's the biggest problem that people look at politicians and they see, gee, well, this politician is giving tax breaks to his corporate buddies, or that politician is giving some sort of benefit to the labor unions, or this other politician is giving benefits to whomever they're giving benefits to. Because the politicians are the ones who are skewing the incentives that cause the problems. If the politicians would get out of the way, then everybody else could just compete fairly. That's what free enterprise is all about. Unfortunately, too many people think that what we have is free enterprise. They look at the banks. The banks are the most heavily regulated industry in the country, and people think that what the banks are doing is free enterprise. And really, what the banks are doing is the farthest imaginable thing from free enterprise. So when the system melted down, people say, oh, look, that's the problem with capitalism. That's the problem with free enterprise. No, 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 no. That's the problem with the incentives created by the current set of regulations.
True, true. I kind of wish that Ron Paul would descend on Occupy Wall Street in Manhattan and try to bring them on board, try to go down there someday and lay out the things you've just said about this is a result of overregulation, and this is not capitalism. This is crony capitalism. This is corporate welfare.
That's
this
right.
is the perversion of capitalism.
That's right.
You know,
I think a lot of the people at Occupy Wall Street are going to be open to some of those ideas, because the people at Occupy Wall Street see that there's something funny going on at the Federal Reserve.
True.
Well, Ron Paul has been leading that charge for a long time.
True. And there's a healthy anti-war climate down there, too.
That's right. And he can say, look, here's my record for all these years against the Fed, against the big banks, against the big corporations, against the bailouts, against the wars. Those people should be saying Ron Paul is our hero, and instead somehow they're saying Barack Obama is their hero. I just don't understand that at all.
I don't understand how Obama, the first black president to bomb Africa.
That is an interesting statement you've just made there.
Well, of course it is, because I said it. Now, I also...
Well, you are the PK, after all.
That's very true. Thank you very much. And not a militaristic one. I'm not a pacifist per se. I, of course, believe in self-defense, as do you, and I'm very pro-gun and very pro-gun ownership, which confounds and confuses a lot of conservatives. Well, how can he be anti-war but very pro-gun? Well, you know, I try
That's
to
right.
explain it. It's just like whenever I see a NRA booth anywhere, I'll go up to them and say, you know, I'm a very proud gun owner. Oh, that's great, good. You're part of an NRA. I said, but I will never join the NRA as long as they support the drug war. I said, we have enough trouble now defending gun rights, property rights, and the drug war has made it so much worse. It's led to more crime, more killing, more innocent people dying. So that's my logic, and I just walk away then.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct, and I think that a lot of people misunderstand. They think somehow the Second Amendment about guns is just about guns, but really the Second Amendment and all of the first 10 amendments are just applications of private property rights. You have the right to keep and bear arms. You have the right to be secure in your home against unreasonable seizures. You have rights laid out in the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, because those are just applications of private property rights. Too many people think that, well, the Second Amendment does guns only. No, no, no. The Second Amendment is about an application of private property. Well, the First Amendment is about religion only. No, no, no. It's about the application of private property. And that's where I think you're being consistent, and too many conservatives are not. You're saying it's the same issue whether it's guns, whether it's drugs, whether it's, you know, homosexuality, whatever it happens to be. The fact is that in your private property, it's your business. It's not somebody else's business.
That's true. What are you talking about, the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights? Is that, does that sort of thing exist in this country? Does actually in existence in this country?
The paper still exists.
What are you, a dinosaur?
But government has all but regulated it out of existence.
Years ago, even the dubious Cato Institute said something about the drug war exception to the Fourth Amendment.
Well,
what are you gonna do?
I don't see that there's any exceptions.
No, I know, but that was their joke. I mean, is there humor, like the drug war exception to the Fourth Amendment? You know, you have a right to remain secure in your papers and property, of course, unless it's drug war related. And the biggest problem about all this stuff is awful TSA. TSA, of course, stands for thousands of sexual aggressors or thousands of stupid a-holes. Thank you very much. I wrote those. And these are other Americans treating us this way. These are other Americans
right.
in all these roles. And I heard there's only like about, when you count, I guess, the military and all the bureaucrats or the police and state police, there's only something like 3 or 4 million people that control the rest of us.
Well, that's the way it's always been. That's the way it was in ancient Rome, and that's the way it was in ancient Egypt, and that's the way it was in the Soviet Union, and that's the way it is here.
By golly. So
we're frogs, and we've been put in that pan of water, and they're turning up the temperature on us.
That's right. That's why I'm very pro nullification, of course, but I'm very pro secession. I'm fond of saying, and I wrote this also, that of course, I'm very pro-South, anti-slavery, of course, but very pro-South. If this was a Civil War time, I would have fought for the South. And as a kid in the North, I grew up in a Northern state, I always had a Civil War hat with the stars and bars. Now, the South wasn't perfect, of course, and they did a lot of things that obviously we wouldn't approve of. But as far as states' rights and, stepping away from a tyrannical government, I'm all for them. In fact, and here's my quote. If American black folks knew what I knew about the Civil War, they too would have fought for the South and worked to reform it afterwards.
Yeah, I'm not convinced of that, PK. I think that when we look at the war, everybody wants to take a side. I think both sides were wrong.
Well, the North
frankly,
was
I
wronger.
Think that I think Lincoln's first attempt was right. You know, Lincoln attempted compensated emancipation. Lincoln came along and said, how about if we buy off all the slaves and free them?
I'm all for that. I didn't know he did that.
That wasn't acceptable to anybody. And we ended up instead with a massive war over half a dozen issues, and maybe the war would have come either way. But that was probably the best solution.
Well, of course,
and that was a solution that nobody wanted in the North or the South. I mean, I'm inclined to say that I'm not going to take a side on that war. Everybody was wrong on something too important to compromise on.
Well, for me, the North was wronger, and I was not familiar with his.
You might argue that the North is wronger.
Thank you.
And the things the North was wrong about might be different from the things the South was wrong about. But I don't see really anything on either side worth fighting for. I think they were all wrong.
I didn't know that Lincoln ever advocated compensated emancipation. And if he did,
absolutely,
it sure wasn't very well known that I've ever heard of.
Just go ahead and look it up. There's a lot of things about the war that aren't very well known until you look into them, and you're like, oh, that's what happened.
Well, I know the outcome. If Lincoln had his outcome, it was the outcome in a nutshell would have been to the slaves. It's okay. Now you've got your freedom. Now get out. We're going to colonize.
Well, that's right. Lincoln definitely wanted to get rid of the blacks. Lincoln, people today think that Lincoln was in favor of equality, but Lincoln was not in favor of equality. Lincoln was afraid that having blacks in close contact with whites was actually going to pull the whites down. So he wanted to free the blacks and get rid of them, which is very different from the view that people have today, that Lincoln wanted to free the blacks and then declare them to be equal in any way, shape, or form. Lincoln did not believe that at all.
He just wanted to free them so he could evict them. In fact, Scott, I don't know if you knew this, but did you know that Lincoln was Jewish?
I did not.
Well, he was shot in the temple.
Ooh. Bad religious humor.
You know what Lincoln said to his wife when the night that he went to the theater?
How many more of these are you going to tell, PK?
He said, Mary, I need to go to the theater like I need a hole in the head. So anyway, thank you very much. That's my two Lincoln jokes. Moving on, Scott, what is your rosy outlook on the future, the economy, and where we're headed?
Well, I think that the economy's got to get worse for about three more years. And I think that's the thing that people don't understand. When we look at the housing crisis, we've got to understand that a lot of the mortgages that have problems, they had teaser rates. That would be a very low rate for the first certain amount of time on your loan, and then the rate would reset according to your actual credit conditions. And a lot of times those teaser rates might be for as much as 5 years. But understand, those mortgages were being written until 2008, which means that there are people with those mortgages that are able to still be in their houses only because the rate still hasn't reset. And when those rates continue to reset today, next week, next month, next year, and they will continue to reset for the next 2 or 3 years, and then people don't necessarily default the first payment after the reset. Some of them try for a half a year or a year or a year and a half to pay those higher amounts before they finally go under. So we're going to continue to see the problem. It's going to keep happening until about 2014, 2015. Until then, there's going to continue to be foreclosures. There's going to continue to be people falling behind. The problem's not going to get any better, and it doesn't matter how much stimulus they try and throw at us, they're just not paying attention to the problem. So I'd say things are going to continue to be bad.
That's very true. I've been saying, well, I said last year, this year's going to be worse than last year, and next year will be worse than this year. It just keeps going that way, and I don't see it improving much. And again, yeah, these stimuluses are just like he wanted, $35 billion this week so we could keep cops and teachers employed and this and that. Well, my first thing would be to say, well, you know, that's the duty of the states in the first place. If Washington wasn't such a useless, expensive middleman, the states would keep most of the taxes in their own state to be used to fund the things that we need to fund in our states, not to give it to you, Washington, D.C., which you are an irreversible cesspool of corruption.
Well, you know, that goes back to the 17th Amendment, which when I talk to the conservatives about the 17th Amendment, none of them ever think about it because they all want to default to the 16th Amendment. But the 17th Amendment was popular election of United States senators. And people say, wait a minute, what's wrong with that, and what did we used to have? But the original idea of the Senate and the House was that the Senate was there to represent the interests of the state, and the House was there to represent the interests of the people. So the House and the Senate were originally supposed to be checks and balances against each other. Something had to be in the interest of the people and in the interest of the state. And if the president was doing his job, he's supposed to look out for the country as a whole. So nothing was supposed to be passed unless it was in the interest of the people and in the interest of the state and in the interest of the country. Only then could something be passed. But once we went to direct election of United States senators, well, now the Senate and the House represent the same constituency, the people. There is no representation of the state at the federal level, which is why the federal government has gotten so bloated. It used to be the Senate was the check on the federal government, and it's not anymore.
Okay, well, let's continue on this. Another thing I'm curious about is, as you know, as the system is right now, should we keep the Electoral College?
Absolutely. That's the last tiny tendril of the checks and balances system. You know, if we go to popular election of the president, then that means that the president and the House and the Senate all represent the same constituency. But if the president, the House, and the Senate all represent the same constituency, then there are no checks and balances left in the system whatsoever. That would be the end of the remaining, the original ideas of the Constitution. We barely have the original checks and balances system. The Electoral College is practically the only part of it left.
That's what I was going to say. We hardly have any checks and balances. So you would keep the Electoral College then?
Absolutely.
But why does it matter, Scott? Because I keep hearing that we are exceptional Americans.
What does that mean?
That means that I hate that term. I have my own reasons for disliking it. Yes, I'm proud and thankful to be born here with the opportunities we have, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't feel that I'm better than anybody else from other countries and this and that. And does a math – I'll rifle some questions to you here now, Scott. Does America have the highest math scores? Do we have the most oil? Do we have the best electronics? Do we make the best cars? You know, so what is this exceptionalism stuff? To me, this is a myth because every country has – intelligent, educated people. America does not have a monopoly on hard work, education, innovation, and technology. Is PK right about this?
Absolutely.
Good. Good. Well, I have to say at this point, you've proven to be quite a valuable, interesting guest because you have the wisdom to cover many topics, as I knew that you would. And so that's a good thing. And I would consider who's ever in your class lucky to have you as a prof because you genuinely care about what you do and, you know, how you say it and your background and all that. Just like I like to say about myself is that I like to be consistent. Consistency is a very important thing, and you're consistent. Ron Paul is consistent. I am also a drummer, and you can ask any musician throughout the world about a drummer. Is one of the most important things a drummer can do is to be consistent, and they will always say yes. So Ron Paul would make a great drummer. Consistency is very important.
Yes, but...
Oh, no.
It's important to be consistent, but you have to be consistently right.
Well, of course.
I mean, you got somebody like Hitler was consistent, but he was just wrong. Joseph Stalin was consistent, but he was wrong. Mao Zedong was consistent, but he was wrong. So I agree, consistency is better than inconsistency. But then if you're going to be consistent, for heaven's sake, be consistently right. You can be a drummer who's consistent and still in the wrong time signature.
Well, I meant consistently correct, consistently right. Yeah, and this whole World War II thing is another discussion. But boy, have I come a sort of full circle about my view on World War II. You know, yes, Hitler was a bad guy and everything. I wasn't going to go into this history thing today. But long story short, I believe that he saved Western Europe from full blown communism because Stalin was planning a major invasion of Western Europe. So as bad as Hitler was. Which was mainly for the glorification of Germany, not the world. It didn't want to conquer the world. That's a lot of mythology as far as I can see it. But this whole thing, and I've heard some things about Churchill lately, was awful how he schemed and what he did to get America in the world and how he dragged Britain down and ultimately ruined the British Empire.
Well, I don't think there's any question that Churchill was a bad guy. I think trying to make Hitler out to be a good guy, I think, is a losing cause, PK.
I'm not trying to
make
him out.
But I think that you're definitely right about communism and Hitler, though. The people were screaming out of the Soviet Union into Germany at the time, talking about all the excesses under Stalin. And so the people said, we need a strong leader who's a bulwark against the Soviet Union. So there's no question in that sense that Hitler was that bulwark. But... Geez, again, it's hard to say that makes him the good guy, because he was clearly the bad guy in so many things.
But again,
we have to put Hitler into his own historical context, because Hitler came to power because the hyperinflation in Germany had destroyed the economy, and the hyperinflation was created by the central bankers, and it was the same central bankers, it was the same families of central bankers that destroyed Germany who came to America and gave us the Federal Reserve System.
And who are still in power today.
Still in power today, that's right.
So we have to
recognize that, again, it was bad government policy that screwed up the economy. And once the economy was screwed up, government took on unprecedented powers, all in the name of stimulus. And once they got their stimulus, then they conscripted everybody, built a massive army, started engaging in genocide against peoples, and invaded their neighbors. So I think, again, it's bad government policy that drove the bad outcome.
Well, of course, I'm not trying to say, I wouldn't say that Hitler was a nice guy, but when I look at in the context of the times, a lot of Europeans didn't like him, but they knew that the only thing standing between them and Stalin was a strong Germany. And Stalin had already, as you know, murdered at least 20 million people before World War II.
Right.
And you know, Hitler still gets the bulk of the hatred, but this is madness to ally with this person who murdered over 20 million people. He becomes your ally. You know, the U.S. should have been stayed out of it, because twice last century, Britain and France picked a war with Germany, a fight with Germany that they could not win without Uncle Sam's money and power.
Well, I think when we look at European wars, I think it's all a little more complicated than that, PK. I think we have to recognize that those Europeans have been at war with each other for, you know, 5,000 years.
Yes,
and
but
every
I'm
war is just a continuation of the previous war. World War II was just a continuation of World War I, and World War I was just a continuation of the Franco-Prussian War, and the Franco-Prussian War was just a continuation of the revolutions of 1848, which in turn were set off by Napoleonic excesses. I think we have to be careful pointing any finger and saying, "Oh, there's the blame."
Well, you
have to go back 5,000 years to find the blame.
Actually, we don't, and this is where I'm not pointing the finger, because before 1900, America was not involving itself in Europe's wars, and this was a watershed, World War I. Of course, the needless war with Spain was, of course, too, a tragic imperialistic nightmare especially for the people of the Philippines. But this brought a whole new thing, because America was set up initially, you know, for religious freedom, religious tolerance, to get away from Europe's civil wars and whatnot, and then World War I brings us back to this nonsense, and so does World War II. So that's a big difference. 5,000 years of European wars, the U.S. wasn't around then to intervene, but now it is, and look what's happened ever since.
Well, yeah, I'm inclined to agree, especially on the Spanish-American War, which is a barely known episode of American history. When you say it was bad for the Filipinos, that's absolutely right. I'd also like to point out it was bad for the Hawaiians.
Of course.
The U.S. Marines basically came ashore and said, "Okay, you're the queen. You're not anymore. You're under arrest. We're taking over. Welcome to America."
Right.
But I'm inclined to disagree with your view about America and religious freedom. When I look at the early settlers, I don't see them coming to America to seek religious freedom, even though that's the stuff we're taught in the government schools. For the most part, what I saw is the different groups of people who all wanted to engage in religious intolerance toward other people. And so if your group is in power in England, your group is screwing over my group. But if my group is in power, my group is screwing over your group. So if you go to America and I go to America, it's not because either of us wanted religious freedom. It's because we both wanted to be able to engage in religious domination somewhere else. So I'm not buying that argument, PK.
As far as the Puritans and the witch burning and all that, I get it. But certainly, maybe there was a third who really wanted just to be left alone and to worship as they choose. As they chose.
Well, perhaps the Quakers.
Yeah.
But they were a fairly small group.
I like them as a model because William Penn, he signed contracts with the Indians. He respected the contracts. He treated them right, you know, unlike the great white father in Washington later on with the genocide of the Indians, courtesy of Lincoln's generals using black troops, of course.
Yeah, and of course, before that, we had Andrew Jackson committing genocide and bunches and bunches of them, so...
Yeah,
well, I think there's no question that you're right about that.
You know, Jackson good about abolishing the Second Bank of the U.S., but bad about so much else.
That's right. Jackson is a friend of mine once said that Jackson is sort of a Shakespearean hero because Shakespeare's heroes were all a little bit larger than life, but their flaws were also a little bit larger than life.
Yes,
so when you look
yes.
at somebody like Julius Caesar... Julius Caesar was great, except that he was horrible. You know, you look at Jackson. Jackson was great, except that he was horrible.
Well, I'd like to think that we Austrian economics scholars have fewer flaws.
Maybe. We also might not be quite as great.
Is great?
See, Keynes was great, but he had huge flaws.
Yeah, well, speak for yourself there.
So I'm not quite as great as Keynes, but maybe I have fewer flaws. So you might be onto something there.
Thank you. I like to think that I'm one of that crowd, the greatness with fewer flaws as far as policy.
You are the rare exception who has that. Absolutely, PK.
Thank you. As far as my own personal life, yes, there's plenty of flaws there. But I certainly like to think that I'm going down the path that – is consistent with the Austrian economics and the ethics of liberty because I don't see what else is going to save us from this mess. In fact, I've been stockpiling food. I fear a civil war between the haves and the have-nots, and many of the have-nots now are just regular working-class people who don't have jobs, and I also fear food riots. So... you know, for my own sake, I've got ammunition and weapons, and I'm stockpiling some food and water because I don't like what I see coming down the pike. Looking out for number one, I have no desire to harm other people, but I'm going to protect mine and you know, my loved ones.
I don't think we know what's going to happen, but what happens could certainly be catastrophic. These are interesting times.
Yeah, and I'm sorry you didn't have to have that discussion. In this country, but that's how I see it, and I'm not optimistic about the future. It's I see more unemployment coming. I mean, Obama's doing is going down the wrong path. I like to summarize Obama with my all-knowing yet humble opinion. Obama to me, thank you. Obama to me is Bush 3 with a makeover on steroids. Obama.
Well, you know, I've been describing Obama in the same way for quite a while. I keep telling people this is Bush's third term because
yes,
Obama
exactly.
kept the same advisors. He kept the same economic policy people. He kept the same people in charge of the military. And he has basically kept every single one of Bush's policies in force. So this is Bush's third term.
That's right. As I like to say, to continue on that, as controversial as some of it may be, I don't really care. It's my view, is that Obama remains clueless about economics, economic history, and political economy. Just like Bush, Obama serves the big banks, Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, and the all-powerful Israeli lobby. Obama may just as well be a mixed-race blue blood skull and bones member.
He might be, for all we know.
Yeah, well, very willing servant of the New World Order. You know, that's, I believe in that that globalist, these globalist aims. And I would say to Clinton, you know, Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, you know, we deplore Carol Quigley. I don't mind his, recollection and investigation and writing about the globalists, but he was an advocate and he approved of it. We stand against globalism and a new world order. We're for a competitive free market society. We reject NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank. IMF, UN, Exim Import Banks, and all these globalist schemes.
Yeah, I think you're right on all counts there. And I think people misunderstand when you talk about something like NAFTA. And NAFTA drives a lot of people nuts because they think NAFTA is about free trade. They say, oh, the American Free Trade Agreement, there's no free trade in the free trade agreement. Listen, so NAFTA is all about government deciding which special interests in America and which special interests in Mexico and which special interests in Canada get special deals. And that's not about freedom at all.
No, that's government-managed trade. Now, Scott, at this point, I would like to thank you very much for coming on my show. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I hope you have. We can go in a lot of directions, and you stay on the horse. You can keep up with me, which is a good thing. So
I've had great fun, PK.
Thank you. I'd like to have you back soon if you'll come back. And I wish you luck.
I think you're
now in a private sector job. You're working. You're out in Nevada doing something with a friend's company or something. So I think you're temporarily out of academia. So, you know, best of luck with what you're doing now. And thanks again. I'm gonna sign off here. And I want to thank everybody for listening in to Third Stream View. We're here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. I'm your not so humble host, PK, saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week, same time, same place. Thanks again, everyone. Good night.